Josh Cooperman, and this is Doctoring Up Design, the official podcast of Design Hardware and Flooring, with a continuation of the last episode, resetting the scene for you. In the last episode of the podcast, we were speaking with HMC architects Kirk Rose and James Krueger about the thought and elements behind design for safety and security. I mean, listen, the world can be a dangerous place, and there is an ongoing conversation about safety and security in design. The one thing that you can count on is the need to put a priority on designing for the unthinkable. The conversation you're about to hear is a continuation of these ideas, and it includes, again, Kirk Rose, healthcare practice leader at HMC Architects, as well as Sergio Lechuga, director of international design at HMC. We met in person at Design Hardware, and check out some of the video clips of the conversation. Please go to at Design Hardware and Flooring on Instagram. We're going to get to this amazing conversation right after this.
Dutch decking company Estec is driven to create and manufacture a sustainable, high-quality decking product for hospitality, leisure, and residential applications. Estec was introduced in 2007. This revolutionary product was originally designed for the boatbuilding industry due to its flexibility. It provides designers and architects with more freedom to create using a sustainable designed composite material. Estec is perfect for nautical and residential decking, as well as facades and other applications you can create. Design Hardware is where you find brands blazing new design trails, like those from Estec. For more information about Estec and other extraordinary companies changing the look and feel of luxury design, visit designhardware.com or on the socials at Design Hardware and Flooring.
To reset the table from our previous conversation, and I'm just gonna sort of reset it here. Mm-hmm. We were talking about, and I love this, Sergio for James. Fantastic.
Hand off.
The idea was, and this is an ongoing conversation, this is not a one-off and then we're done. The premise is, and we've talked about this before, that architects are futurists. And you're not designing for today. You look at a project, if it's a... architects are designing for 75, 100, 150 years. I mean, that's the goal, right? A designer is designing for 5, 10, 20, 25 years because that's the goal. And for design, you can do a refresh, but a building, a structure is a structure. And maybe it's longer now. We can get into that. And then we started talking about and thinking about what is security? What is safety? The nature of safety and security in civic centers, hospitals, schools, has radically changed in the last 20 years. And I'm going to assume that it's going to change again radically in the next 5 to 10 years because the cycle is speeding up. And then we started talking about and thinking about how some of those ideas could be applicable to a residential environment, especially with everything happening globally. You know, if you look at what's happening in Israel, where many people are just sort of waking up to the fact that an Israeli home has a safe room. If you have a kitchen and you have a garage and you have a living room, you have a safe room because it's just part of the build in that part of the country. Parking structures have bomb shelters because that's part of the need. If they weren't needed, they wouldn't be there. Nobody would just go and build something like that because they wanted to build a concrete structure, right? So that's the idea. So we're kind of building on this conversation that we had last time via Zoom. For those that haven't listened to the podcast, please go listen to that one. And so that's the premise. That's what we're talking about. And let's reset the table here. Sergio, I'll start with you because James was in your seat last time. Sure. So maybe a little bit about yourself and what you do. And then after that, Kirk, you can sort of reset an sure. introduction as well.
Yeah. So Sergio Lechuga, I'm a director for interior design for HMC Architects. So I went to school, studied architecture. Have practiced in architecture, but in the course of my career, decided I was, you know, really wanted to focus on what I did in interiors and experiential design, and how, and you know, of course, in our markets, you know, healthcare, education, or K-12 and higher education, you know, really focus on that, and create, you know, while may not be the sexiest environments, very important environments. And to this topic, you know, how do we create these safe environments where people learn, you know, get healthy, you know, critical things that we need as humans. You know, how do we design these types of spaces that are safe and welcoming and you know, create a positive experience for people?
And I'm Kirk Rose, healthcare practice leader for HMC. Sergio and I work together on projects. In our firm, the leaders are actually architects and designers in most cases. And in my career, it's been mostly healthcare for the last couple and a half decades, but curiously, I worked on theme parks, movie theaters, and did an aquarium in the past. So that informs my work. But also, a lot of what I do is deal with the clients and what are their issues. And so when we talk about safety, I think there's both the issue of protecting people and then the also the issue in public buildings of access, and those can be at odds. And so we often find very surprising learnings about our clients who really do want to preserve access, and they want to preserve an openness to the places and to the institutions that are serving people. So it's up to us to be innovative in how to solve these problems and keep people safe at the same time.
You know what's interesting? I flew in for this, and I was having a conversation with the flight attendant on Southwest, and we were sort of, we were both probably this around the same age, and we were talking about, I hate to be that guy, but we were talking about the good old days. Like, do you remember when flying was a thing and going to an airport was a special occasion and you could walk all the way to the gate,
right.
All the way in. Right. You could
to
just
see him off.
Yeah, you had to walk through the Hare Krishnas and the solicitors, but it was like in an airplane kind of fun way, you know, where it was a happening. Yeah. It was an experience. It's tedious now. The security has taken over the experience. And I would imagine that's something that you have to think about when you're incorporating those ideas. How do you start that process? And where does the idea of form, function, experience, how do they all work together? Where do you start in the thought process?
Well, I think, you know, when we're talking about specifically around security, that's always the top of mind, right? That's the first thing that our clients are, in K-12 specifically, right, they're concerned with, right? But, you know, so obviously, you know, the spaces have to perform, they have to function, they have to meet the needs in the program that the client has set out for us to do, along with addressing the safety concerns that their specific community, is concerned with. But we have to balance it again with the experience, right? So when, you know, students come in, we don't, you know, walking through like an airport, right? You have to go through metal detectors, you have to go through different layers of security, and so that's not the experience, that's not a healthy experience for young people to have to go through in an educational environment. So we're designing these buildings, these facilities, so that the security features are built into how we design, how we organize the buildings, the program, with these layers of porosity, so that the security is not perceived, or it's not in your face or blatant, but that you're walking through these layers that protect and limit how people enter the building, but doesn't take away from how people experience the environment and the security or that specific space.
I can give a specific story or stories in parallel of a few hospitals when we are designing emergency rooms, either replacements or additions to existing. And one of the big questions becomes, should we have a metal detector?
Right.
Sometimes they have an existing metal detector and they say we hate it, or it's not effective. You know, someone could actually throw a gun over, so someone gets through, you can throw a weapon over and get the job done. And there's concern in certain public hospitals, in certain neighborhoods, of if someone's been injured, say, in a conflict, say, a gang violence, and someone may be wanting to come back to, quote-unquote, finish the job. And so this is a real safety issue for everyone in the department. Ironically, when we talk to them and we talk about what really deters people, it's often other humans. And this gets to the residential environment. You know, you don't always have another human in your house, but hospitals have employees. And so in many cases, we've ended up saying, to preserve access and to acknowledge the fact that the metal detector is not foolproof, we get rid of the metal detector, and then they have a security presence, and then they manage that security presence to deter people, and then they have operational protocols to alert people if someone's suspicious looking or things like that. There are also multiple layers in the department to get back to the patient, and so there's a sort of a security protocol in the waiting room, and then you can't get back. There might be a secure door that's done by card key or something like that. So there's ways to do it, as Sergio has mentioned, with schools that preserve that access. The public may not know what the security protocol is, but when something happens, it's taken care of pretty quickly. But the conventional wisdom of, oh, if you have a metal detector, or oh, if the front door is locked and stuff like that, it makes it very difficult for them to achieve their mission of a place that everyone can come
right.
for care, and that's open and that's public.
We talked about this idea of form and function and experience, and driving in today, I was reminded, and I wanted to ask you about this, because it seems like the solutions are too simple. Driving in today and looking at some homes in West LA, where every home, neighbor, there are bars on the windows, bars on the doors. At some point, that affects the mental, the state of mind, right? The level of comfort. If you're looking out at bars every day, you're looking out the window and you're seeing bars, maybe at some point you don't see those bars every day, like you don't notice them, but you still know that they're there.
Yeah.
When you're looking at schools, if you walk into a school and you're walking through a metal detector, through three layers of fencing, and you're looking out the window and you're seeing a perimeter fence, and you're seeing, that has to affect the mental state of mind. And then
absolutely.
when does that space lose its efficacy to do what you're trying to get it to do? How do you approach, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, schools didn't have perimeter fencing, most anyway. I don't know a single school that doesn't have perimeter
right.
fencing
right.
anymore.
Yeah. We try not to, as much as possible, use perimeter fencing, so we use our buildings, we organize the buildings as sort of that first perimeter around the building that acts as the gate, acts as the perimeter, and we limit the number of openings to the campus. So when we talk about sort of creating a courtyard or a ring of buildings, it doesn't necessarily have to be a circle, but it's using the buildings as the perimeter with the center core, with clear sight lines, so that when people are in the center core, there's line of sight, there's visual access, but we're limiting sort of the penetrations into that center core, right? Limiting access as much as possible, so that we're using that the buildings as that perimeter fence, right? But we're also, again, it's softening it by, having windows and other things, art, public art, things that we can sort of create a face for the community and have it not be a fence, and really soften that edge a little bit.
And you think too about civic spaces, and I would imagine hospitals and civic spaces are more alike than with schools, because schools, you have authorized personnel that are supposed to be in the school, students, teachers, mm-hmm. educators, administrators, parents, mm-hmm. right? When you have a hospital, you're triaging. You have no real say in who's coming mm-hmm. into. When you have a civic center, I mean, I will tell you something, if anyone wants to just be horrified and amused simultaneously, watch an LA City Council meeting. I watched one the other day. I was in a hotel room, and it just happened to be on TV, and I was both amused and absolutely horrified at the public comment section. I mean, I'd never seen anything like it. These are not necessarily people who are mentally stable, and here you have these individuals who are the targets of this
yeah.
vitriol and anger
yeah.
and emotion,
yeah.
you can't necessarily control. Now, you've got all kinds of police presence, but once something happens, then it's all reactive.
Yeah, quick reaction.
So how do you think about, okay, here's the situation, here's who's going to be here, how do we make the environment as secure as possible without making it prison-like?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the example of hospitals and civic buildings, the perimeter has to be open because these are public facilities, and
yeah.
you have to welcome the public. And then, as you say, some of the public may be a threat. The real line of security is usually the area where it's staff only. So certainly in a hospital, even when we deal with patient dining and staff dining, we secure between the two when the owner wants that. And the back of house areas, the place where employees work, there's a secure perimeter with card readers. So now out in the public area, it becomes, watch and identify and react quickly. And there may be security guards in something like a city council meeting or police and sheriff. In hospitals and civic buildings, there may be no security presence some of the time, or there may be a roving security presence. So there needs to be operational protocols if something happens. And usually they've got them in place and all the employees are trained and they know how to do something quickly. I haven't heard many conversations about arming the employees the way we've heard conversations about arming teachers. Mm-hmm. All of the line of sight stuff that Sergio talked about is real. We want to make sure we design these spaces so that there's nowhere to hide. I know in students' cases, we want them to have safe places to hide once a shooter's known inside. So, visual access and alerting. I'm reminded of the residential example, which I experienced in my neighborhood of next door, where, there's a house that we know is bank-owned, and there's a squatter living in there. I'm getting daily updates about what's happening, and we're all keeping our eyes open. And if something does happen, then one of us will call the sheriff. So it's kind of good old-fashioned awareness, communication, and then people helping to subdue the bad guys. And I've heard of stories in hospitals where, they had an individual who, this happens in emergency departments too, where somebody's mentally ill, they may not even have medical conditions, but they show up, and so they've got to do a protocol. Sometimes they have the sheriff watch them, sometimes the staff watches them and is just on alert in case something happens. So there's really no way to avoid the human component of that. A security camera can only do so much, and we have those too, but they don't really identify the violence potential the same way that a human could when observing.
But I think you bring up a good point, Kirk, about engaging the community, because that's what we did at Del Oro, right? We engaged the community, we engaged the students, right? That particular high school had a very high population of gangs within their student population. In that design of that particular facility, we were engaging the community, partnering with them. Even after the school was built, they were a presence within the community. How we designed that school and the classrooms and gave students the autonomy to learn and move about the campus because it was secure from the inside, and that helped not completely solve, but ease some of the security concerns of gang violence, different people coming onto campus when they weren't, allowed, right? Is that there was parent involvement, student involvement, and even how faculty and administrators, taught their classes and interacted with the students. It all changed. So it was all of those things that helped create a more safe environment for the students.
What I refer to as an operational protocol. It's like everyone knows what to do in different scenarios, and I think that's an important part of the response.
And Sergio, do me a favor, make sure you speak up because I want everyone to hear what you're saying. Along those lines too, when it comes to the design, and here's where the rubber meets the road, right? Especially as it relates to hospitals, civic centers, schools, the budgets are well established in advance. I'm not saying this in a de minimis way, but I think that they're probably more well planned out than the typical residential environment, because I think you have to. So many more moving parts, sure. So much more goes into it. When you think about the design ideas and you're looking at a project, and I would imagine that you have to start with these ideas of, okay, security, safety, we're going to start with perimeter, and then we're going to move in. Is that where the design idea starts, or it's always the form follows function, follows form, again, this whole idea, but where does that idea start? And are there any ideas as you're talking through this that you can say, here are some thoughts that would apply to the residential environment? Because I feel like the level of education on the public structures is so far greater to the typical and average residential environment, right? So we can learn so much more going in that direction. How do you think about that, and where do you start ideating this?
I have a thought here. So, I mean, in college, in architecture school, we had a cool professor who taught us this concept called aleatory space, which is space that nobody takes ownership of, right? So in the public realm, schools, hospitals, and civic, the institution controls what's on their property. They take ownership and they have full authority over it. But if you're in a residential situation, it's all individual homeowners really looking out for their own interest. And then there's the street, or there's vacant lots, or the vacant house I mentioned. And that's where you find things may happen, you know. Or, you know, you go down to Skid Row and you see all these people that are out in the public realm. So that aleatory space needs to be handled somehow. And whether it's a combination of people taking interest in their own neighborhood and just stepping up and saying, we're gonna keep our eyes open and we're gonna communicate and we're gonna manage it, or involving public authorities. I mean, a recent example, there were some students killed at Pacific Coast Highway on a traffic accident, which is a safety issue. So now the city and all the agencies are trying to take control of Pacific Highway and say, what are we going to do? We're gonna have higher police presence, we're gonna install cameras. There are a lot of different security things being discussed and funded immediately in that aftermath of that sad tragedy. So it's figuring out, in a residential context, what are the spaces that are not managed by individuals. Most individuals look after their own property because they have a stake in it, and then figuring out some sort of a public strategy to deal with that space.
Yeah, I mean, I think it, you know, translating these ideas, you know, from public institutions into private, it's I think it's challenging because I think budgets are always tight, but the strategies how we implement security into our homes is very different than how we do that in a public realm, public institution. So, I think it's challenging, but I think potentially, you know, like you mentioned, you know, how do we, you know, protect, you know, our perimeter? I would say the same thing, right? We're always going to protect the inside, you know, or the perimeter of the house, you know, relying on our community, all of those same things.
We could bring up what we were just talking about before the camera was turned on, ideas like the Ring doorbell.
Right.
You know, I was in a meeting with a client, and she's like, oh, someone's stealing a package at my house.
Yeah.
So
right.
She got on the phone and started yelling at him, I'm calling the police. And she was in a meeting 50 miles away. So those kinds of technologies can help us when we don't have human presence or an alarm or something else.
I feel like what most people don't realize, and again, it's not diminishing what they do or how they do it, but most people don't realize that the police are not there to protect you. Mm-hmm. And when I say that, sometimes people are like, well, protect and serve. Yeah, it's right there. No, they're not there to protect you. They're a reactionary force. They're a deterrent by their mere presence, by the idea of a police force. That's meant because there are laws, and if you get caught breaking the laws, then you go through the process. But they're not there to say, oh, Sergio, I'm going to make sure that nobody breaks into your house.
Sure.
That doesn't. And by the way, anyone who's ever been violated in that, car stolen, car broken into, home broken into and robbed or burgled, the when you call the police, it's really funny because they will come out and they'll do this assessment and like, wow, you really should have done that, or wow, I'm surprised you didn't do more. And it's like, wow, thanks for that.
Yeah.
I could totally do without that right now.
And
maybe
they'll come out 4 hours after it happened because they
four
got
days
so many
after
calls that are hotter.
If they come at all.
If they come at all. Think that most people, when you put it that way, then they start to think about it. It's like, oh yeah. Then you get to really meaningful action,
what can I
activity.
Do?
It's like, okay, you know what? I have insurance. Great, that's after something happens. There's a police force. Great, that's after something happens. What can I do today to keep something from happening? And it's funny because if you, you'll generally talk to older folks who will say, well, back in my day, we didn't lock our doors.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We left the windows open. I left the keys in the, you know, on the visor.
I'm going to go to something really simple, right? And I don't think it's anything that you can necessarily buy. It's getting to know your neighbors, getting to know your community. Honestly, right? I live in a community that I think is relatively safe. We've had some situations, but most of the time, I've had someone, actually two of my neighbors, come up to me and say, I saw someone walking by your house and looking behind your, you know, behind your tree or something. I had a neighbor across the street who saw someone who he didn't recognize from my community, from my street, looking into the cars. And this was at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. He has to get up early to go to work. We were obviously still asleep. He called the police reactionary. What he did was he screamed, or he said, "Hey, you know, what are you doing?" Right? Because he was getting into his car, he saw that someone was by my car, and he was looking out for me, but for his community, right? But I think because I had that relationship and that rapport with my neighbor across the street, with the neighbors on both sides of me, we had that sense of community where we're looking out for each other. I don't think there's anything that I could have done to prevent someone from walking in off this, off the street, so to speak, mm-hmm. right? Coming into my community and, you know, looking into my car, you know, seeing if I left the car unlocked and whatnot. You know, we're all asleep, right? You know, I have a car alarm, the doors are locked. You know, that's going to deter him, but that's not going to prevent him from breaking in and doing what he wants to do, right? Sure, we have the security lights, the floodlights, and all those things, but really what deterred him was the fact that I was lucky in this case, that the neighbor was able there at that moment and was looking out for me, you know, for his neighbor. Right.
So let's talk about this idea of layers and levels, right? Because when you're designing for a hospital, for a school, for a civic center, for a public space, if you're doing it right, most people never see
right.
or recognize the layers and levels that go into this.
That's
and
right.
maybe it starts with, you know, an open visual plan and then a landscape opportunity, mm-hmm. and then as you get closer to the heart of the structure, it starts to get more and more pronounced. What are those layers and levels?
Well, we kind of didn't mention the basic on a lot of the medical campuses. There's a pretty extensive network of cameras, and you know, people are watching them. They have a monitoring station. In some of our public hospitals, the sheriff is on site
right.
and fully staffed 24/7, looking at all the cameras. So that's kind of the first layer. And then we also have to say, how many cameras, where are they? And there was an interesting story recently where one of them wanted to have a license plate scanner. And mm-hmm. the hospital said, we don't want that because we may actually have some criminals who are bringing their family members for care, and you should be catching the criminals, but not on our campus. If that's an unrelated thing, go do the license plate scanning out in the community somewhere. But generally, identifying that kind of thing on the perimeter, identifying that thing in the public spaces, and then again, back in the staff spaces, there's security to get there. But we also have things that people may not know, like you can't steal babies because there is an infant abduction system. It's an infrared system in a hospital in the labor and delivery unit. The exit doors, which are normally open for people to exit in case of a fire, have a delayed egress, and that delayed egress sets off an alarm. So if someone grabs the football, i.e. the baby, starts running for the touchdown, they try and get out the exit door, it'll take 15 seconds, the alarm will go off, and there's an operational protocol where a nurse who's nearby is notified, and the nurse goes and intercepts them. There's a second operational protocol where someone's standing at the bottom of the stairs at the same time in case they do get into the stairwell and they can't get out. So there's a lot of security. We have professional consultants who help us design these things. And depending on the department, the nature of the public space, whether it's emergency labor and delivery, the unique issues of things that criminals might do, there's a very sophisticated response pre-planned, both in the building and in the way that the people operate it.
Here's what's fascinating to me, yeah. too. You talk about stealing of infants.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when my kids were born, and my kids are a little bit older, and I remember...
None of them were stolen?
No.
Oh, good. Okay.
But I remember the process
yeah.
where they explain,
yeah.
like, here's what we do, and here's... And I hate to be so cynical, but that's a business decision. Because if you're a hospital and you have an infant stolen, it's going to make the news. If it makes the news, mothers are not going to want to deliver their children at that particular institution. So it's a matter of motivation. Right, it's for the good, but
they all do it though. I mean, it's kind of like a base thing now, where
it is
a really
now.
Important thing to do. Yeah. But maybe there was a time when it was just first coming in.
You know, I what I'm saying is, and I agree, I totally get it, that they all do it now because they all hire the consultants to do that. I don't know of many, I should say, the average homeowner, the average residential home builder does not include a security consultant that goes into the process of building there. Most designers that I speak with don't really ever go into, yes, I bring in a consultant to talk about the security. It's a question of motivation, because if the homeowner's not asking for it, and there's no, do you know what I mean?
I mean, you have to maybe triage between a single family residence where you're right, although some in a gated community have high levels of electronic security and they may have surveillance, they may have a security service. But in a, say, a large high-rise in an urban area,
right,
they've got a security design. They're probably all very similar, right? Someone in the lobby,
right,
card key access, perimeter cameras, a little bit like an institutional building. But I would imagine they're cookie cutter, and as you say, I imagine they don't have a custom consultant evaluate the project each time. They probably just have a protocol.
And I'm wondering, I want your take on this too, because I feel like this is the next level. So pre-pandemic, right, air quality, water quality. Those were big issues. And those are even recent. Those are 10 years, 15 years that people have really started thinking about these ideas. Middle of the pandemic, noise pollution, both internal and external. So it's like if you're doing a Zoom meeting on Monday morning at 10:30, you can pretty much be assured that either your neighbor's going to let their dog bark, or that that's when the gardener's going to come to mow the lawn on either side or your own.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That became a real thing. Then the issue created thought leadership, and that thought leadership created solutions to the problems. Then you have this idea that,
or the phone will ring when you're doing a podcast. Yeah.
It's so funny. I am so used to that now, like I don't even think twice about it, but the point is well taken. It's absolutely true, and it's well timed. It's usually me that's
you
talking.
Made that happen.
I made it happen. But then the idea, I feel, and I want your take on this, that security is a new source of luxury. Luxury and security are now synonymous. Like, that's something that many people, when you're thinking about luxury and design, security has to be a part of that calculus.
I mean, I have a thought about just foreign countries. I do like to travel. This one does too. We're very paranoid about security here, and we're very individualistic. You know, as Sergio gave the example of the neighbors, a lot of people in the United States don't really interact with their neighbors,
right,
and they live in fear and all that stuff. And of course, it's natural as people get older, also they're more in fear because they're physically more vulnerable to that. But I do think it's maybe even a necessity in our culture because people have that kind of more isolated view. People's children don't live with them anymore, and so you know, you don't have a network. Some people are living in a either alone or with friends and family that are far away. So security becomes very important to them emotionally. Even in foreign countries, you see neighbors helping neighbors in a way that often you don't see in the United States, just culturally.
But I do agree with you that security has become a form of a luxury because not everybody can gets access to it,
yeah,
right? And the fact that one can choose to live in a gated community, can choose to hire an alarm company. I think in certain communities, the fact that there is a community where we're like-minded individuals of the same socioeconomic status, that is a luxury.
Okay.
That is a luxury.
Okay. So, impromptu activity. I love these. I love snap polls. Audience participation as well. Have you had a package stolen from your porch?
No.
Have you had a package stolen from your porch?
No.
Have you ever had a package? Yes. Yes. Have you ever had a package? No. Have you ever had your car broken?
What about you?
Oh, yeah.
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 Okay.
Have you ever had your car broken into? Or stolen?
Yes.
No.
Never broken into or stolen? Never broken into or stolen? Never broken into or stolen? Yes.
Yes.
But I will tell you, where I had my car broken into was not within my community. I was somewhere else.
Yeah.
Right? you know, what we're speaking of is privilege, right? And not everybody has the same privilege and access to what we are talking about as a safety and security within our homes, right? And that's unfortunate, but that's a reality. And so, you know, how do we, and even when you talk about, you know, residential design, and what does safety really mean, right? Safety means very different things for people, right? Even in your home, right? We're talking about sort of physical security in terms of perimeter and fencing and all of those things. While that is a concern in residential design, that may not be the thing that people are most concerned about when they're talking about their safety and well-being within their personal space. They may be thinking about, well, do I have asbestos and things in my house that is a danger to my health and my children's health, right? Safety and security. Do they have, you know, is their home heated? And, you know, do they have all of the things that, you know, give them that comfort and that safety, that, you know, the safety within their own home? And, you know, so I think we needed to define within the residential context what does safety really mean. And I think it's going to be something different for everybody depending on where you live and, you know, all of the things, right? So
just a quick comment. And since we started this conversation about safety and moving it into residential, I've talked to dozens of designers and architects about the subject, and the biggest reaction I've had is, nobody's asked me for it.
So
at what point do we say it becomes part of how we design, whether it's perimeter, your homeowners associations won't let you put up big fences and you can't do this and you can't do that. My grandchildren left alone in a big house, what do their parents tell them to do if somebody's breaking in? Where do they go? What do they do?
Mm-hmm.
No police, don't dial 911, that's not going to help.
Right.
So at what point does it become basic and residential that we have the discussions?
Yeah,
it's a question for me.
Yeah, and you can't solve everything with design. I mean, a lot of it is telling your children, hey, if this happens, call 911 and then go to the basement and lock the door.
Go to this room, lock the door, go in the closet, lock the door.
Get back on track. Mm-hmm. So it's a great point. This is an academic conversation,
mm-hmm.
right? Because, and again, back to these ideas, and the ideas stem from this thought process. Schools do not look or operate the way that they did even 5 years
right.
ago. Hospitals do not operate or even look the way that they did 5 years ago, which is amazing because they're almost triaging their security protocols as we go because the world is changing so rapidly. And then I started thinking about something you said, like how much of that is reality versus perception,
mm-hmm.
and how much of that even matters. You know, if you don't feel safe,
right.
you're not safe.
Right.
You know
of
what
course.
I mean? So when it comes to a hospital or a civic center or a school or any public space, you know, go to a movie theater and try not to think about Columbine. Or to think about Colorado.
Right.
It's a thought, so it's a mental thing.
Right. I mean, I could think, if you're extrapolating from the past, what about the future? And we had this conversation before we started on AI. So we've got security camera. What if the camera could listen, and the camera analyzed motion, and the camera had data that says, well, if an individual's moving a certain way, or if they say certain things, they're a security threat. We're probably not far from that point, right? And then eventually, if that becomes available for public buildings, then the cost will come down. It'll be available for residences. So in a way, now you've got a fake human watching your house inside and out, figuring out if the suspicious character is displaying movement or sounds that make it suspicious. I mean, I'm kind of taking a leap here, but maybe that kind of thing will eventually become something that can help people feel safer because they know that, you know, when no one's home, you know, what was the name of the computer? And
Hal.
Hal's watching the house. Thank you. You know what I mean?
I do.
So, you know, that kind of stuff could be happening. People could be thinking about it now.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because a few years ago, I did a piece where I was analyzing this video that was produced by Westinghouse in the 50s. And it was called The Whole Electric Home. and it was hosted by Betty Furness. I just remember at the time, but it was in the 50s and it was colorized and it was everything, but it was amazing. And I'll put a link in the show notes so that you can go back and you can watch this. It's on YouTube. But they were talking about the process of the whole electric home. It's done in the 50s. And what was so amazing about it was the predecessor for the Ring doorbell. Mm. So basically, it demonstrated in this fake but real home, walking up and pushing a button, and then in the kitchen, you know, you got to see it where it blinked, and then it and then and then it came on screen, and you got to see a video of who was at your door. Mm-hmm. This is back in the 50s.
Why did it take 50 years to make it a reality? It should have been quicker. Yeah.
Because finally someone got motivated to say, and it was, I think it was the Ring guys, you know, it was like, we're going to take the idea of CCTV right. and make it a reality.
But it used to cost $5,000 to put cameras on your house, sure. and now it costs like $200. So that's part of it, is making it affordable. Right. Yeah.
Okay. So along those lines, and again, we have so many great conversations before we hit the little red button and start recording. It's amazing. And we started talking about AI, and I think that that's fascinating. Does that play a role in how you design? Do you think about that yet? VR, AR?
Absolutely.
And we talked about hospitals last time.
We're having secret conversations we can't tell you about on this podcast. No, I mean, we all are. I talked to an architect who's quite well known the other night at the Laker game, and he's got a robotic arm in his studio that he's messing with, that he's thinking of having design his buildings in 3D. So the answer is yes, but how the heck do we know without doing our research where this is going to go? Because there are so many paths that it can take, unlimited in a way, including automated threat analyses, right? Mm-hmm. We could plug in a floor plan, plug in a neighborhood, it'll go search the crime data, it'll look at our floor plan, and it'll spit out, here's your, you know, security risks, which currently, obviously, we hire a consultant to do, but the consultant doesn't have that amount of data or is able to digest that data and really analyze.
The interesting thing about VR is that we're using it every day now, right. And the wonderful thing is that our clients can see the spaces, can start to feel what the physical reality is going to be before anything gets built, right? So they can start to see, I have blind spots here. I need more visual access to the patient rooms or to the main lobby, so that way, you know, because that wall, that beautiful wall that I designed, is right in the way. And so we're using the technology to help improve and inform the design decisions that help, you know, with security and all of the function and programming elements that is required for the building to perform, right? So we're using the technologies. You know, how does AI come into, you know, we don't totally know yet, right? How do we use analytics, you know, to start to inform those things? We don't know yet.
Yeah.
So, you know, as we, you know, as a technology and continues to improve, we're all headed in that direction, right? We have to just figure out what it means and how it informs the design process.
I just want to add, so, and I agree, you know, a client looking at a floor plan doesn't see the space and think of the things they think of when they're in the space every day, like security or just other operational things. Also, we have a business in its infancy called simulation modeling. So, like, we'll do the emergency department,
right.
And little tiny fake humans will, you know, bring the patient to the room and all this stuff. It kind of looks like Pac-Man, you know? But we could be, in the future, running security analyses in addition to operation analyses using simulation modeling. So we could say, hey, Hal, you know, gun person comes in this door
right.
at 10 a.m. on a Friday, and there's, you know, 25 patients in there. What happens? And it could actually run a model. And so that kind of stuff's coming.
Walk me through this. What does that look like? So when you're doing a VR program, mm-hmm. are you all participants, all stakeholders, wearing the goggles?
Absolutely.
Meta? Whose goggles are you wearing?
Google Glass? Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Meta's got Oculus.
Right.
And then
it's Oculus, Google Glass. We've used a couple of different versions.
And then
we've had a cardboard version where you stick your iPhone
right.
in the
yeah.
cardboard.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You did
yeah.
use those.
Yeah.
Yeah. We still use them.
Yeah.
You still use them.
Well, because the headphones are expensive, and so depending on how many are in the meeting or if all the headphones are being used.
Right.
Yeah.
I have never spoken, doesn't mean they don't do it, but I've never spoken to a residential designer or architect that has employed VR. So you've been doing it for a long time. What does that look like? What goes into that? What tools do you need, and how do you operate that?
I think it's commonplace in our practice now. It's again, we've been doing it for a long time. That's, you know, we as designers, I do it to understand, you know, aesthetics. You know, is this the right quality of space? Is enough light coming in? So it's imperative that we do it before anything gets drawn. Is it right? You know, does it perform the way it's intended to perform? We go in there every day, you know, as we're drawing, designing, building in our, you know, 3D modeling programs. We just quickly shoot it over to the rendering program. We take a spin and we walk it around and we say, okay, this doesn't feel right. The ceiling's too low. This wall's too high. It's not open enough. You know, we put ourselves in the model every single day before it gets to the client, in which then we give you the goggles and we say, okay, we want you to walk through your building. You know, does this feel right? Right, because once you have those goggles on, you're in that.
What program are you working in at this point?
It's Revit and Enscape.
Okay.
Yeah. We're already drawing the building in 3D in Revit, right. And think of it as an outline drawing,
right.
And then the rendering software gives it surfaces.
Right.
So it used to be cumbersome to give it surfaces, and it's getting quicker and quicker. So you know, you don't want to do it for every space in the building,
right.
But we could.
We could.
And we have walkthrough fly-throughs that we do for presentations where
right.
You start outside, you walk around the outside,
right.
You go in the front door, you go in the lobby, you go up the stairs, and you're in the procedure room. So we render the spaces that we want to look at, and then the ones that we don't or that are repeated, the toilet room, or if there's
right.
10 of the same room, we render one of them and we don't render the other 9.
I would imagine, too, that, and it's funny because this is one of the things that we'll be talking about on the AI conversation, because it's fascinating imagining a scenario where a designer, be it residential, commercial, industrial, can work with a client and run through a VR scenario, or you know, with a project that's underway, an AR scenario, where you employ AI to that and say, okay, as we're walking through, show me where somebody can hide.
Yeah.
Show me where there's a blind spot. Show me
right.
where there's, you know, if the algorithm is complex enough, show me where there's a perceived issue that I don't see,
right.
And it can
yeah.
how can those
are matters of geometry. So you could do a script and say, if there's a space that's, you know, not visible more
right.
than 3 square feet. I mean, we do this in acute site design.
That's right.
We literally look at the floor plan and say, from a sight line, is there a space more than a certain number of square feet, which is the space that a human would occupy,
right.
hiding in the corner. And so we already do that, but not mechanically. The AR would help us.
And we do that in daylight analysis and view
right.
analysis to
right.
the exterior, right? Not specific to security, but we have, you know, tools that measures the view range of people from certain perspectives. Again, this is more dealing with daylight and views.
The amount of sunlight
penetrating
and how deeply it penetrates.
Right.
That.
But we're already doing that.
Do you also use the same tools for specification and product analysis?
Probably not as much.
Not as much, right? Now BIM, right? It's building information. You were putting all of the information. A lot of manufacturers and companies are giving us their products and tools to put into our models because it helps us as designers, right? And it hopefully gets them specified, right? But
and complex equipment. So the medical equipment will come as a 3D model with
right.
attributes, and we'll plug it in. But I think the next step is for the building materials to tell the model automatically what's the R value, what's the transmittance of the glass. We're not quite there yet, but it's very soon.
Well, and what I think is fascinating, too, is sometimes you have to convince people to move in the right direction, or what we perceive to be the right direction. And, you know, it's funny because I've had designers who will say to me, I don't think I've ever had an architect say this, but designers, because designers think differently than architects, they really, really do about the creative process. Like, what's in it for me? Why do I want to do this? My client's not asking for it. And
it's more work and more hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And those, by the way, those are all rational, salient, great points. My response has often been that what's in it for you is by understanding how to do this and offering it as a service to your clients. You know, how many clients do we have that don't, you probably not so much, but how many clients on the residential side do designers have that the clients don't know what they want or what they don't want? They really, really don't. Their clients are not good clients on the residential side for the most part. And I don't say that, again, it's not a negative. It's that a residential homeowner who's employing a designer to do their work kind of does the handoff thing where it's like, you know, you're the designer, you do the work. So they don't know what they don't know. And when there's an additional cost for something like security design, for a designer to say, look, this product, that product, this service, this idea will make your home safer. Who doesn't want that? And for the designer, it adds to additional billing. For an architect, if you can add additional services, those additional services can create additional billing, which is what's in it for the creative, right?
Those things will be additional services for a year, and then they'll become a basic service. I mean, think of the evolution. We used to charge for CAD time. That was a funny thing, right? Extra this. So as the technology evolves and becomes more cost-effective, a lot of times it does inure to the benefit of architect. We can either offer more for the same price eventually. Maybe we'll charge for a year, but then everyone else is doing it, and it becomes part of our offering.
So it's
we used to sell the accuracy of CAD and say, well, you'll avoid change orders during construction because we won't fudge the dimensions. Well, now the client is like, you know, don't tell me that. You shouldn't be doing that in the first place.
We're still selling the accuracy of
BIM. But when we renovate and we tell the client we want to laser scan a whole building and it costs $1 million for a big building, they're like, why? And what's my benefit? So, I think all of these things will end up making architects and designers provide a more sophisticated service. And, you know, maybe the market value will go up. Maybe the owners will pay for it.
But it's funny, in that analysis, you're talking about $1 million cost against $1 billion hospital, right? It's almost like
it's
that's
nuanced. In this case, they were upgrading the infrastructure of an existing 800,000 square foot hospital. All the mechanical equipment was getting changed out. And so we wanted to model the building envelope and all that. It actually didn't make sense to do the whole building in a scan. So we ended up scanning certain regions of the building. So you just do a cost benefit analysis for all this stuff.
And it's funny, it reminds me of the Billy Bean quote in the movie Moneyball. I don't know if you ever saw
it.
It's a great movie, and it reminds me of this. He was like, you know, adapt or die.
Right.
And we're at an inflection point right now.
Right.
We really are, because we're reaching this really interesting space and place in time where AR, VR, AI, all of the tools that are available, the problem is, for most of the creatives that I speak to or speak with, they don't have the time to learn everything new.
Right.
Time is a problem. And when you don't have the time, but you can lean in on technology to sort of do some of that learning so that you can make the process of activation easier. You work on world-class projects. And you have to know these things, and you have to put the work in, and you have to put the time in. Where do you think the opportunity is, not to cut corners and not to, but where is the time saving? Where is the, like, here's where technology actually makes life easier for the creative instead of more difficult? Like, I have to learn SketchUp, and I have to learn CAD, and I have to learn all these other things.
So I personally think, using AI, people that hire architects and designers, I think, don't necessarily need us to paint pretty pictures or to design. I think they need us to validate the design, right? Because I think AI is going to, it already is, creating these derivatives of all these different things that you can pull from. You can type into, Midjourney and say, I want a, two-story house that is mid-century mod with views, all these things, and it will paint you a picture, right? It will, plus minus, give you a pretty good design. I think the value that I think that's the time savings, I think, because we're not having to render, we're not having to build models to create these things. I'm not saying that we shouldn't design. What I'm saying is we need to validate the designs. So when we put, is this the right flooring? Is this the right, orientation for windows and doors? Does this space, the way it looks, aesthetically perform the way you need it to perform, whether it's in a, hospital or school? I think we bring value in understanding, the needs of our client ensuring that the building is performing the way it does. Not to paint a pretty picture and not to paint, you know, not to select flooring and not to select paint. Yes, that's part of what we do, and it is an important aspect of what we do. But if a client says, I think we're going to get to a point where if we're charging or we're spending 40 hours on creating pretty pictures for a client to see their space, I think we're going to be out of business real soon, because I think our competitors are leveraging the technology to help us design in that way, and where we bring expertise is ensuring that the building is performing and functioning to their needs.
So I agree completely, Sergio, and I would add the two categories where it's always going to help us is the elimination of repetitive tasks and the right. ease of incorporating changes. Right. And so you think of a draftsperson, make the building 12 inches longer. Okay, I have to erase half the building yeah. and redraw it. We can do that now in seconds. Or this door hinge needs to be, for door type 1, which occurs 1,872 times, needs to be changed. Right. We just push a button. So that's going to help. But the thing that's going to make it accessible, I think it's like 80% of the architects in the U.S. are a member of a firm that's five or less people, something like that. So it's going to be user interface. Like, who can't use an iPhone in the world?
Right.
You go to the poorest country, to the least educated person, it's intuitive. And that was the genius of Steve Jobs, is I'm going to bring the most powerful handheld device that's going to give you the access to all the information ever thought of by any human being, and any human being can operate it. So eventually, the software designers are going to get feedback from us and our clients and say, I'm going to make a better user interface. I'm going to automate repetitive tasks. We used to have to render. You know, people used to color things.
Right.
Remember that?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So not anymore, right? Push a button. So that's going to enable us to do more decision making. We call it creativity, although we debated,
right.
do you need a human for creativity?
Right,
and that's
exactly.
the next podcast, right? Because that's a really deep subject. But more time on creativity, less time on the infrastructure. And a more universal user interface that even the creatives who aren't very tech savvy can get on it and work with it.
When I think of architects and designers aren't harnessing the technology, aren't adopting the technology, they're going to be out of business real soon.
Absolutely.
On my phone, I can go with the program and I can start measuring just by using my camera on my iPhone and getting very accurate dimensions of an existing space.
They're going to remodel this space soon. Can we do that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, so if you're not taking advantage of that...
Yeah.
Imagine going around with a tape measure and you've got Sergio with his phone.
Right.
You're going to propose to the client,
right.
I have a 30-hour task, and Sergio's going to say, 5 minutes, I won't even charge you for that.
By the way, it's the funniest thing in the world, because I'm working on a design house project and I was doing the measurements of a room. I'm not a designer. I was doing the measurements, and the designer I was talking to, when I sent her the numbers, she was like, you suck at this. This is terrible. Like, you're really, really bad.
Because now you know him.
I did it all by hand. Well, and then
I'll share the program with you that you can use on your iPhone.
I'm going to take you up on that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. This was really great. And to your point, yes, this is installment 2 of our conversation. And I'm not going to say 2 of how many, because I have a feeling this is a living, breathing thing. This is going to keep going. We're going to have an ongoing series.
Thank you, Kirk and Sergio, for your time and expertise. Thank you, Bruce Boll with HMC, for making this incredible conversation happen. Thank you, Michelle Solomons and Avi Balsam with Design Hardware, for your continued and unwavering support of the design and architecture community. And thank you for listening to the podcast. I love hearing from you, love learning about new products and guests you think should be featured on the podcast. So email me, convobydesign@outlook.com, with ideas and suggestions for the show. Until the next episode, be well.